The Augsburg Confession. Chapter 2. The Coronation. Charles, like Charlemagne in former times, and Napoleon in later days, desired to be crowned by the Pope, and had at first thought of visiting Rome for that purpose. But Ferdinand's pressing letters compelled him to choose Bologna. He appointed the February 22nd for receiving the Iron Crown as King of Lombardy, and resolved to assume the Golden Crown, as Emperor of the Romans, on the 24th of the same month, his birthday and the anniversary of the Battle of Pavia, and which he thought was always fortunate to him. The offices of honor that belonged to the electors of the empire were given to strangers. In the coronation of the Emperor of Germany, all was Spanish or Italian. The scepter was carried by the Marquis of Montferrat, the sword by the Duke of Urbino, and the golden crown by the Duke of Savoy. One single German prince of little importance, the Count Palatine Philip, was present. He carried the orb. After these lords came the emperor himself between two cardinals, then the members of his council. All this procession defiled across a magnificent temporary bridge erected between the palace and the church. At the very moment the emperor drew near the church of San Petronio, where the coronation was to take place, the scaffolding cracked behind him and gave way. Many of his train were wounded, and the multitude fled in alarm. Charles calmly turned back and smiled, not doubting that his lucky star had saved him. At length Charles V arrived in front of the throne on which Clement was seated. But before being made emperor, it was necessary that he should be promoted to the sacred orders. The Pope presented him with the surplice and the amice to make him a canon of St. Peter's and of St. John Lateranus, and the canons of these two churches immediately stripped him of his royal ornaments and robed him with the sacerdotal garments. The Pope went to the altar and began Mass, the new canon drawing near to wait upon him. After the offertory, the imperial deacon presented the water to the pontiff, and then kneeling down between two cardinals, he communicated from the Pope's hand. The emperor new returned to his throne, where the princes robed him with the imperial mantle brought from Constantinople, all sparkling with diamonds, and Charles humbly bent the knee before Clement VII. The pontiff, having anointed him with oil and given him the scepter, presented him with a naked sword, saying, "Make use of it in defense of the church against the enemies of the faith." Next, taking the golden orb, studded with jewels, which the Count Palatine held, he said, "Govern the world with piety and firmness." Last came the Duke of Savoy, who carried the golden crown enriched with diamonds. The prince bent down, and Clement put the diadem on his head, saying, "Charles, Emperor Invincible, receive this crown which we place on your head, as a sign to all the earth of the authority that is conferred upon you." The emperor then kissed the white cross embroidered on the Pope's red slipper, and exclaimed, "I swear to be, with all my powers and resources, the perpetual defender of the pontifical dignity and of the Church of Rome." The two princes now took their seats under the same canopy, but on thrones of unequal height, the emperor's being half a foot lower than the pontiff's, and the cardinal deacon proclaimed to the people, "The Invincible Emperor, Defender of the Faith." For the next half hour nothing was heard but the noise of musketry, trumpets, drums, and fifes, all the bells of the city, and the shouts of the multitude. Thus was proclaimed anew the close union of politics with religion. The mighty emperor, transformed to a Roman deacon and humbly serving Mass, like a canon of St. Peter's, had typified and declared the indissoluble union of the Romish Church with the state. This is one of the essential doctrines of popery, and one of the most striking characteristics that distinguish it from the evangelical and the Christian church. Nevertheless, during the whole of the ceremony the Pope seemed ill at ease, and sighed as soon as men's eyes ceased to gaze on him. Accordingly, the French ambassador wrote to his court that these 4 months which the emperor and Pope had spent together at Bologna would bear fruit of which the King of France would assuredly have no cause to complain. Scarcely had Charles V risen from before the altar of San Petronio ere he turned his face towards Germany, and appeared on the Alps as the anointed of the papacy. The letter of convocation, so indulgent and benign, seemed forgotten. All things were made new since the Pope's blessings. There was but one thought in the imperial train, the necessity of rigorous measures, and the legate Campeggio ceased not to insinuate irritating words into Charles's ear. "At the first rumor of the storm that threatens them," said Granvelle, "we shall see the Protestants flying on every side, like timid doves upon which the Alpine eagle pounces." Great indeed was the alarm throughout the empire, Already even the affrighted people, apprehensive of the greatest disasters, repeated everywhere that Luther and Melanchthon were dead. "Alas," said Melanchthon, consumed by sorrow, when he heard these reports, "the rumor is but too true, for I die daily." But Luther, on the contrary, boldly raising the eye of faith towards heaven, exclaimed, "Our enemies triumph, but ere long to perish." In truth, the counsels of the elector displayed an unprecedented boldness. "Let us collect our troops," said they. "Let us march on the Tyrol, and close the passage of the Alps against the emperor." Philip of Hesse uttered a cry of joy when he heard of this. The sword of Charles had aroused his indolent allies at last. Immediately fresh couriers from Ferdinand were sent to hasten the arrival of Charles, and all Germany was in expectation. Before carrying out this gigantic design, the elector desired to consult Luther once more. The emperor in the midst of the electors was only the first among his equals, and independent princes were allowed to resist another prince, even if he were of higher rank than themselves. But Luther, dreading above all things the intervention of the secular arm in church affairs, was led to reply on the March 6th in this extraordinary manner. "Our prince's subjects are also the emperor's subjects, and even more so than princes are. To protect by arms the emperor's subjects against the emperor would be as if the burgomaster of Torgau wished to protect by force his citizens against the elector. What must be done then?" "Listen," replied Luther. "If the emperor desires to march against us, let no prince undertake our defense. God is faithful, he will not abandon us." All preparations for war were immediately suspended, the Landgrave received a polite refusal, and the confederation was dissolved. It was the will of God that his cause should appear before the emperor without league and without soldiers, having faith alone for its shield. Never perhaps has such boldness been witnessed in feeble and unarmed men, but never, although under an appearance of blindness, was there so much wisdom and understanding. The question next discussed in the elector's council was, whether he should go to the Diet. The majority of the counselors opposed it. "Is it not risking everything," said they, "to go and shut oneself up within the walls of a city with a powerful enemy?" Bruck and the Prince Electoral were of a different opinion. Duty in their eyes was a better counselor than fear. "What?" said they. "Would the emperor insist so much on the presence of the princes at Augsburg only to draw them into a snare? We cannot impute such perfidy to him." The Landgrave, on the contrary, seconded the opinion of the majority. "Remember Piacenza," said he. "Some unforeseen circumstance may lead the emperor to take all his enemies in one cast of the net." The chancellor stood firm. "Let the princes only comport themselves with courage," said he, "and God's cause is saved." The decision was in favor of the nobler plan. This Diet was to be a lay council, or at the very least a national convention. The Protestants foresaw that a few unimportant concessions would be made to them at first, and then that they would be required to sacrifice their faith. It was therefore necessary to settle what were the essential articles of Christian truth, in order to know whether, by what means, and how far they might come to an understanding with their adversaries. The elector accordingly had letters sent on the March 14th to the four principal theologians of Wittenberg, setting them this task before all other business. Thus, instead of collecting soldiers, this prince drew up articles. They were the best armament. Luther, Jonas, and Melanchthon, Pomeranus remaining at Wittenberg, arrived at Torgau in Easter week, asking leave to deliver their articles in person to Charles V. "God forbid," replied the elector. "I also desire to confess my Lord." John, having then confided to Melanchthon the definitive arrangement of the confession, and ordered general prayers to be offered up, began his journey on the April 3rd, with 160 horsemen, clad in rich scarlet cloaks embroidered with gold. Every man was aware of the dangers that threatened the elector, and hence many in his escort marched with downcast eyes and sinking hearts. But Luther, full of faith, revived the courage of his friends, by composing and singing with his fine voice that beautiful hymn, since become so famous, "Ein fest Berg ist unser Gott, our God is a strong tower." Never did soul that knew its own weakness, but which, looking to God, despised every fear, find such noble accents. "With our own strength we not can do, destruction yawns on every side. He fights for us, our champion true, elect of God to be our guide. What is his name? The Anointed One, the God of armies he, of earth and heaven the Lord alone with him, on field of battle won, abideth victory." This hymn was sung during the Diet, not only at Augsburg, but in all the churches of Saxony, and its energetic strains were often seen to revive and inspirit the most dejected minds. On Easter Eve the troop reached Coburg, and on the April 23rd the elector resumed his journey, but at the very moment of departure Luther received an order to remain. "Someone has said, 'Hold your tongue, you have a harsh voice,'" wrote he to a friend. He submitted, however, without hesitation, setting an example of that passive obedience which he so boldly advocated. The elector feared that Luther's presence would still further exasperate his adversaries and drive Charles to extreme measures. The city of Augsburg had also written to him to that effect. But at the same time John was anxious to keep the reformer within reach, that he might be able to consult him. He was therefore left at Coburg, in the castle overlooking the town and the rivets, in the upper story on the south side. It was from this place he wrote those numerous letters dated from the region of Birds, and it was there that for many months he had to maintain with his old enemy of the Wartburg, Satan, a struggle full of darkness and of anguish. On the May 2nd the elector reached Augsburg. It had been expected that he would stay away, and to the great astonishment of all, he was the first at the rendezvous. He immediately sent Dalzig, Marshal of the Court, to meet the Emperor and to compliment him. On the May 12th Philip of Hesse, who had at last resolved on not separating himself from his ally, arrived with an escort on 190 horsemen, and almost at the same time the Emperor entered Innsbruck in the Tyrol, accompanied by his brother, the Queens of Hungary and Bohemia, the ambassadors of France, England, and Portugal, Campeggio the papal legate, and other cardinals, with many princes and nobles of Germany, Spain, and Italy. How to bring back the heretics to obedience to the Church was the great topic of conversation in this brilliant court among nobles and priests, ladies and soldiers, counselors and ambassadors. They, or Charles at least, were not for making them ascend the scaffold, but they wished to act in such a manner that, untrue to their faith, they should bend the knee to the Pope. Charles stopped at Innsbruck to study the situation of Germany and ensure the success of his schemes. Scarcely was his arrival known ere a crowd of people high and low flocked round him on every side, and more than 270,000 crowns, previously raised in Italy, served to make the Germans understand the justice of Rome's cause. "All these heretics," was the cry, "will fall to the ground and crawl to the feet of the Pope." Charles did not think so. He was, on the contrary, astonished to see what power the Reformation had gained. He momentarily even entertained the idea of leaving Augsburg alone, and of going straight to Cologne, and there proclaiming his brother King of the Romans. Thus, religious interests would have given way to dynastic interests, at least so ran the report. But Charles V did not stop at this idea. The question of the Reformation was there before him, increasing hourly in strength, and it could not be eluded. Two parties divided the imperial court. The one, numerous and active, called upon the emperor to revive simply the Edict of Worms, and without hearing the Protestants, condemn their cause. The legate was at the head of this party. "Do not hesitate," said he to Charles. "Confiscate their property, establish the Inquisition, and punish these obstinate heretics with fire and sword." The Spaniards, who strongly seconded these exhortations, gave way to their accustomed debauchery, and many of them were arrested for seduction. This was a sad specimen of the faith they wished to impose on Germany. Rome has always thought lightly of morality. Gadinara, although sick, had painfully followed in Charles's train to neutralize the influence of the legate. A determined adversary of the Roman policy, he thought that the Protestants might render important services to Christendom. "There is nothing I desire so much," said he, "as to see the Elector of Saxony and his allies persevere courageously in the profession of the gospel, and call for a free religious council. If they allow themselves to be checked by promises or threats, I hesitate myself, I stagger, and I doubt of the means of salvation." The enlightened and honest members of the papal church, and of whom there is always a small number, necessarily sympathize with the Reformation. Charles V, exposed to these contrary influences, desired to restore Germany to religious unity by his personal intervention. For a moment he thought himself on the eve of success. Amongst the persons who crowded to Innsbruck was the unfortunate Christian, King of Denmark, Charles's brother-in-law. In vain had he proposed to his subjects undertaking a pilgrimage to Rome in expiation of the cruelties of which he was accused. His people had expelled him. having repaired to Saxony, to his uncle the Elector, he had there heard Luther, and had embraced the evangelical doctrines, as far at least as external profession goes. This poor dethroned monarch could not resist the eloquence of the powerful ruler of two worlds, and Christian, won over by Charles V, publicly placed himself again under the scepter of the Roman hierarchy. All the papal party uttered a shout of triumph. Nothing equals their credulity, and the importance they attach to such valueless accessions. "I cannot describe the emotion with which this news has filled me," wrote Clement VII to Charles, his hand trembling with joy. "The brightness of your majesty's virtues begins at last to scatter the darkness. This example will lead to numberless conversions." Things were in this state when Duke George of Saxony, Duke William of Bavaria, and the Elector Joachim of Brandenburg, the three German princes who were the greatest enemies to the Reformation, hastily arrived at Innsbruck. The tranquility of the Elector, whom they had seen at Augsburg, had alarmed them, for they knew not the source whence John derived his courage. They fancied he was meditating some perfidious design. "It is not without reason," said they to Charles, "that the Elector John has repaired the first to Augsburg, and that he appeared there with a considerable train. He wishes to seize your person. Act then with energy, and allow us to offer your majesty a guard of 6,000 horse." Conference upon conference immediately took place. The Protestants were affrighted. "They are holding a diet at Innsbruck," said Melanchthon, "on the best means of having our heads." But Gattinara prevailed on Charles to preserve his neutrality. While this agitation prevailed in the Tyrol, the evangelical Christians, instead of mustering in arms, as they were accused, sent up their prayers to heaven, and the Protestant princes were preparing to render an account of their faith. The Elector of Saxony held the first rank among them. Sincere, upright, and pure from his youth, early disgusted with the brilliant tourneys in which he had at first taken part, John of Saxony had joyfully hailed the day of the Reformation, and the gospel light had gradually penetrated his serious and reflective mind. His great pleasure was to have the Holy Scriptures read to him during the latter hours of the day. It is true that, having arrived at an advanced age, the pious Elector sometimes fell asleep, but he soon awoke with a start and repeated the last passage aloud. Although moderate and a friend of peace, he yet possessed an energy that was powerfully aroused by the great interests of the faith. There is no prince in the 16th century, and none perhaps since the primitive times of the Church, who has done so much as John of Saxony for the cause of the gospel. Accordingly, it was against him that the first efforts of the papists were directed. In order to gain him over, they wished to put in operation very different tactics from those which had been previously employed. At Spires, the evangelicals had met with angry looks in every quarter. At Augsburg, on the contrary, the papists gave them a hearty welcome. They represented the distance that separated the two parties as very trifling, and in their private conversations made use of the mildest language, seeking thus to entice the credulous Protestants to take the bait, says an historian. The latter yielded with simplicity to these skillful maneuvers. Charles V was convinced that the simple Germans would not be able to resist his star. "The King of Denmark has been converted," said his courtiers to him. "Why should not the Elector follow his example? Let us draw him into the imperial atmosphere." John was immediately invited to come and converse familiarly with the Emperor at Innsbruck, with an assurance that he might reckon on Charles's particular favor. The Prince Electoral, John Frederick, who on seeing the advances of the papists had at first exclaimed, "We conduct our affairs with such awkwardness that it is quite pitiable," allowed himself to be caught by this stratagem. "The papist princes," said he to his father, "exert every means of blackening our characters. Go to Innsbruck in order to put a stop to these underhand practices, or if you are unwilling, send me in your place." This time the prudent Elector moderated his son's precipitancy, and replied to Charles's ministers that it was not proper to treat of the affairs of the Diet in any other place than that which the Emperor had himself appointed, and begged, in consequence, that His Majesty would hasten his arrival. This was the first check that Charles met with.